Okay, we are wrapping up Jacob's blessings, and with it, the book of Genesis. The usual order here of the after Judah, and we are, let's start in verse 13 with Zvulun. We don't know exactly why, but the birth order is reversed. Issachar is actually older than Zvulun, but Zvulun gets the blessing before Issachar. This is just one more example of the Torah reversing birth order, which is, as you know, a constant theme in the book of Genesis, over and over again, that the younger takes precedence over the older. Why it happens here is not clear, but what you get in the blessings, if you look at 13, for example, is when it says, Zvulun shall dwell by the seashore. He shall be a haven for ships, and his flank shall rest on Sidon. That's a geographical description of where the tribe of Zvulun was. So either, as I said last time, Jacob is through prophecy knowing where the geographical boundaries of Israel will be, or this is written afterwards once someone knows what the geographical boundaries are and it's retrojected into Jacob's mouth. The other part of this is, remember that if you look in the book of Joshua, and it's funny, the book of Joshua, I mean, it should be the climax of the Torah. It should be the book of the Torah in some ways, because after all this, we're going to enter the land of Israel. Joshua is the book in which we finally enter the land of Israel. So you would assume that the book of Joshua would be the great climax of this story. But in fact, it's a sort of difficult, bloody book with a lot of fighting, conflict in Israel, but mostly conflict with other tribes. And you can see that even in the biblical account, the conquest of Israel in Joshua and then on in Judges and Samuel and Kings is a very gradual and not entirely military affair. That is, there are treaties and negotiations, and then, you know, someone violates it, and you have a war, and sometimes there's uncertainty, and sometimes Israel loses the war, and then you have to determine why Israel lost the war. So there's a famous incident in the book of Joshua where Israel loses an entire war because somebody took spoils from a previous battle that they weren't supposed to take, which raises its own ethical issues. That is, why do you make all of Israel lose a war because one guy did something wrong? It's not a book that, if you listen to 100 sermons by 100 different rabbis in 100 synagogues, my guess is you'll never hear the book of Joshua mentioned. It's just not one of the books that people refer to again and again or quote again and again, which is strange, but it also lets you know that when we're talking about the borders of the land of Israel, it took a long time to establish those borders. You shouldn't have the impression, not even from the Torah, much less from modern scholarship, but you shouldn't have the impression that Israel invaded, took over, established their borders, and we were done. It wasn't like that at all. And you remember that also two and a half tribes stayed on the other side of the Jordan. They didn't even take land in the land of Israel. So when you get this discussion of the geographical boundaries, we just have to be aware that the geographical boundaries they took a long time to establish, and they didn't last for all that long, because after a couple hundred years, I mean, when I say they didn't last for all that long, they lasted probably longer than the United States has been around. But in Jewish history, they didn't last all that long, because a couple of hundred years later, the Northern Kingdom was destroyed, and then there were no more boundaries anymore. So maybe there was 200-300 years that they managed to establish themselves in. I remember my teacher, Simon Greenberg, said to us once, and I don't remember the context, but he said to us once, there's one good drash in all the book of Joshua. It's when Joshua, it's the night before a battle, and Joshua sees an angel standing in front of him with a sword, but he doesn't know it's an angel. As often happens, this is a separate topic, but as often happens in the Torah, people see angels and they don't know that they're angels, which tells you something about how angels appear, at least in the time of the Torah. So Joshua comes up to him and says, are you with us or with our enemies? And he says, no, I am an angel of the Lord of hosts. And Greenberg said, notice that he doesn't even deign to say, I'm not with you or with your enemies. What he says is, you're thinking in the, just says no, like you're thinking in the wrong categories. God doesn't take sides that way. And when you start to invoke God that way, the only proper answer is no. So it is a good drash, actually. But there's more than one in the book of Joshua. But his point was that this book, which you would think is such a climax, turns out to be not such a great addition to the biblical canon if you're looking for inspiration. So Issachar is a strong boned ass, Chamor Garim, which is obscure. We don't know exactly what that means. It might mean that he's dense, or it might mean that he's strong, or both, for that matter. When he saw good was security and pleasant was the country, he bent his shoulders to the burden and became a toiling serf. In other words, he works the same way that a donkey works. And then the best blessing that you get apart from Judah is Dan's. Dan Yadin Amo, Dan shall govern his people as one of the tribes of Israel. And this is clearly, it was a small tribe, according to Sarna here, in a precarious position. But apparently, judges came from Dan. And in fact, we know that that there is this tradition of judges coming from the tribe of Dan. But in the book of Joshua, it doesn't even say what the boundaries of Dan are. So for whatever that means, it also lends the word for judgment in modern Hebrew, Dan and Din, to the same, it's the same root. So it could also be partly punning. Then there's one of those obscure parables which may have to do with guerrilla warfare. That's at least one of the speculations. Dan shall be a serpent by the road, a viper by the path that bites the horse's heels so that his rider is thrown backwards. In other words, Dan doesn't fight the way other tribes fight straight on. They fight stealthily. And then all of a sudden, in the midst of it, there's this prayer, which I always found strange. It says, I wait for your deliverance, O Lord. But apparently, this is a common pattern in ancient blessings. That is, you stop in the middle of the blessing to invoke God before you return to the blessing, as though it almost feels like taking a drink, like it's renewal, right? Just to remind yourself that this is the source of all blessing, and this is where you go for blessing, and so on. The following blessings are also generally either border or warfare blessings. God shall be raided by raiders, but he shall raid at their heels. Asher's bread shall be rich, and he shall yield royal dainties. That is not a fertility, but a productivity blessing. There's another word that I can't summon. In other words, that they'll grow, that their crops will be good. Naphtali is a hind let loose, or which yields either beautiful words, Imre Shefer, or lovely fawns, depending on which you prefer. Imre Shefer, again, it's a unique phrase. And when you have a phrase that doesn't appear anywhere else, it's very hard to know how to translate it, which is one of the reasons why I'm zipping through this poetry. Joseph is a wild ass. And what do you notice about the fact that Joseph is mentioned? Who's not mentioned? Ephraim and Manasseh. And why, remember from last time, is he? Because that way you get to 12 tribes. You mention Ephraim and Manasseh, you get 13. The Bible doesn't want 13 tribes, it wants 12, as we talked about last time. And again, it talks about his being firm, and it's a pretty good blessing. And it also may have some reference. Ve'yemarehu v'robu, the archers bitterly assailed him, they shot and harried him, yet his bow stayed taut and his arms were made firm by the hands of the mighty one of Jacob. This may refer back to the story of Joseph too, right? Where people tried to assail him, but he successfully made his way through with God's help and succeeded. So it could refer to the future. It also could refer to the story we just read. And then it goes on to talk about Joseph's blessings of his father. the God of your father who helps you, and Shaddai who blesses you with blessings of heaven above, blessings of the deep that crouches below, of the breast and the womb, blessings of your father surpass the blessings of my ancestors to the utmost bounds of the eternal hills. May they rest on the head of Joseph, on the brow of the elect of his brothers. One thing to notice about this, by the way, and about Joseph in general, which is a fascinating thing, when we talk about why, remember at the beginning, and several times it recurred, we said we were going to talk about why Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and not Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and Joseph. One thing that is interesting to note about Joseph is that God never speaks to him. God never speaks directly to Joseph. Joseph has dreams, but nowhere does it say. In fact, if you go back to and this is kind of an interesting thing. When Jacob comes to bless Joseph's kids, where is it? One second. When Jacob comes to bless Joseph's kids, this is what he says. He says, not there. It's a little before that. 38:15. Hold on, guys. Just a sec. There it is, 46, chapter 46, when Israel sets out to Egypt, okay? Israel set out with all that was his, and he came to Beersheba, where he offered sacrifices to God of his father Isaac. God called to Israel in a vision by night, Jacob, Jacob, and he answered here, and he said, I'm God, the God of your father. Fear not to go down to Egypt. I'll make you a great nation. I myself will go down with you to Egypt. I myself will also bring you back, and Joseph's hand will close your eyes. Okay? God says that to Jacob as he's going down to Joseph. He never says anything like that to Joseph. Never says anything to Joseph, for that matter. But even when Jacob is going to bless Joseph and his children and be reunited, God's still talking to Jacob and not talking to Joseph. Now, why that is not entirely clear, but I'll make a suggestion, even though it doesn't fit very well with Moses. Okay? Here's the trajectory of the Bible in general. Just broadly speaking, at the beginning of the Bible, God is constantly talking to people all the time, right? Telling them what to do, what not to do. As the Bible proceeds, God recedes. And you get less and less and less of God's intervention until at the very end of the Bible, you get a book like Esther where God isn't even mentioned in the Bible at all. It's not just that God doesn't intervene, it's that God isn't even mentioned in the book. But God's gradual withdrawal from human affairs is a theme of the Bible. There's a really good book about it, by the way, called The Disappearance of God by Richard Elliot Friedman. And in this book, what's most interesting about it is Richard Elliot Friedman wrote a very famous book, which I, by the way, urge you to read. It's a very easy read, and it's a fascinating book. It's called Who Wrote the Bible? And it's all about modern scholarship on the Bible. If you want to know what modern scholars think of it, it's a little tiny bit outdated, but it'll give you the basic idea about why modern scholars think people wrote the Bible instead of God. And it was a bestseller and so on, fine. So Friedman is a modern scholar of the Bible, and he thinks people wrote the Bible, right? Obviously, that's his whole book. But then he comes to write this book called The Disappearance of God, and he says, if you follow the way the Tanakh is put together, it's eerie how exactly it follows step by step by step God's disappearance. As though it were put together in a way to show you, and he traces it, and I don't want to say elaborately, but he traces it very clearly, how it goes from this much involvement to God, this much, until God's completely gone. He says, now for a scholar like me, this is very puzzling, because my assumption is these books were put together over many generations. They were recombined. It's partly accident. It's partly happenstance. He says, but then I look at this pattern, and I can't explain how a pattern like this could have happened if it was purely coincidental. So it's a really interesting book, and he's very forthright about it, and he's a very clear writer. And from my little exchanges with him, it seems to be a very nice guy. He teaches down in San Diego. I don't know if he still does. But in any case, he says, you know, I can't explain how this could possibly come to be. And what you get in Genesis is something of the same thing, which is when you get to Joseph, God is less involved directly, not maybe not indirectly, in Joseph's life. But Joseph is called Yosef HaTzadik because he's always invoking God as opposed to God always talking to him. With Jacob, God's always talking to him. With Joseph, God never speaks to him. So when we say the prayers and we say our ancestors, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, maybe it's because they're the ones who are so unlike us, right? We're closer to Joseph in a way because Joseph is the one who's always talking about God, and maybe Joseph has dreams and maybe we have dreams, but Jacob, we don't have dreams like that where you get up and God says to you, by the way, you know, hi there. That's not us, right? That's, so to speak. And it's a different level of inspiration. It's a different level of inspiration. It's almost like what I always say about reading Heschel. Heschel is the most inspiring and moving of modern Jewish theologians. You read him and he gives you wings. There's nobody like Heschel. But you also know there's nobody like Heschel. So you finish his book and you're inspired and it's beautiful, but you also think to yourself, God, he's like a different order of human being from what I am. I can't be like him. So even though it's inspiring, it's also, you realize that he's writing from a place that you might reach in brief moments of inspiration, but you can't stay there. And it's the same thing here. In some ways, Joseph is a better hero for us because he's closer to us. Because who can be like Jacob, where God's always intervening and telling him what to do? Or like Moses, where God's always intervening and telling him what to do? But we understand someone like Joseph, who's a little opportunistic, and he's a little vain, and he's a little manipulative, and he's angry at his brothers, and he tortures them a little bit because of what they did to him. You know, we understand all that. And also, he thinks he knows what God wants, and he invokes God, but God never comes right out and says, listen, Joseph, this is what is going on, the way God does with Jacob. So that may be why he's not one of the Avot. But it's just, as I said, it's speculation, like all the other reasons why he's not one of the Avot. And let me just finish with the blessings. We're on the last blessing, which is Joseph's younger brother, Benjamin. Binyamin Ze'ev Yitraf, which means Benjamin is a ravenous wolf. In the morning he consumes his foe, in the evening he divides his spoil. Again, a really good blessing if you're going to be a warrior tribe, which they all were. And so these are the tribes of Israel, 12 in number, and that's what their father said to them as he bade them farewell, addressing to each a parting word appropriate to him. Okay, so that's remember that the sequence is Jacob calls Joseph's children, he blesses them separately, they get their own blessing, and then all 12 tribes get a blessing. And what we may not remember, although you will as soon as I say it, if you've been through the class, is when Jacob steals the blessing from Esau and he fools his father and then he gets out of there as fast as possible because he doesn't want Esau to know that he did it. And Esau comes. Do you remember what Esau says to his father? He says, don't you have a blessing left for me? And his father says, yes, I still have a blessing for you, and he blesses him. That question is made more poignant in a way because Jacob's got a blessing for everyone. All the kids get blessings. And it's not a question that all of them will get blessings. And that's an important precedent for Jacob to set, that you shouldn't think that once he's blessed Ephraim and Manasseh, there's no blessing left for the other children. It gives you this sense that blessings are as abundant as people. But they don't all get the same blessing, just like Jacob and Esau didn't get the same blessing. So there are infinite numbers of blessings, but no two blessings are entirely alike. Even though the way we bless our kids, I talked about this in the sermon 2 weeks ago, even though the way we bless our kids is exactly alike over and over and over again, right? You should be like Ephraim and Manasseh, you should be like Sarah, Rivka, Rachel, and Leah. But the truth is that every individual blessing is individual and should be individual, even though there's a broad blessing for everyone. So let's read the end of Jacob. Then he instructed them, saying to them, I'm about to be gathered to my kin. Now, remember, these are his last words. And this is Jacob. And so you have to think about think to yourself, what are the appropriate last words for the patriarch of Israel whose name becomes the name of the people? He says, bury me with my fathers in the cave which is in the field of Ephron the Hittite, the cave which is in the field of Machpelah facing Mamre in the land of Canaan, the field that Abraham bought from Ephron the Hittite for a burial site. There Abraham and his wife Sarah were buried. There Isaac and his wife Rebekah were buried. There I buried Leah, the field and the cave in it, bought from the Hittites. Now, what interests me is that they're very specific instructions, as though, first of all, they might not know where it is, or they might not remember where it is, but also he emphasizes that this is purchased land. It belongs to us. So you should know, in case anyone asks you, why do you get to do this? It was purchased from Ephron by Avram. And you can imagine in the ancient world that that's how land was claimed, right? You didn't have deeds and you didn't have recording and so on. And so you had to be able to say, this was bought from this one. And presumably, since, remember, people weren't mobile, it's rare for a tribe to move down to Egypt. All the people in the city are going to remember, oh yeah, we remember Ephron. We remember we heard the story about how this piece of land was purchased here and this piece of land was purchased there. And there, as you know, and I've mentioned in other studies, people's memories, which were trained, were much, much better than our memories tend to be, especially for things that we don't need to remember. And the purchase of land and things like that were things that were remembered. If you've ever gone to a ketubah signing, in a ketubah signing, there is, in the Ashkenazi tradition, there's what's called a Kabbalat Kinyan. You accept a handkerchief or a kippah or something else, and that's to show the witnesses, they're supposed to remember, yes, I remember that he accepted the obligations in the ketubah, right? So as I mentioned to you when I was at the conference in Mexico, Joshua Four spoke, who wrote a book called Moonwalking with Einstein, I think it was called. And he started to study these people who entered memory contests. And he discovered that, in fact, most of them started out with average memories. Some of them had unusual memories, but most of them started out with average memories, but they learned how to train their memories to remember long sequences of things that seem impossible. And so he was studying it, and he said, the truth is, it's kind of boring to study memory. People says the most exciting thing that happens is someone goes like this, you know? He says, but they just stare at pages. So someone said to him, look, the only way you're going to be able to really write about this is if you do it. So he entered the memory contest, and he won. He won the American. He lost in the internationals, but he won the American contest. And he said, it's amazing how, if you train yourself properly, and the techniques are known from ancient times, you can remember an extraordinary number of things, but you have to work at it and learn the techniques and use it and so on and develop that part of your brain and all of that. So in the ancient world, you needed to do that. It's not unusual for Jacob to say, these are the instructions. You can go right back to that town and everybody will, not everybody, but at least whoever the recording secretary of the town is should remember who bought what from whom. When Jacob finished his instructions to his sons, he drew his feet into the bed and breathing his last was gathered to his people. Now you're going to ask me what that means. and the answer is that we don't know. It says, by the way, that where is it? The very first verse of the chapter. 1 second, I will show you. If you look at the beginning of the chapter, it says, Jacob calls his sons and says, Hey Asvu, gather together. And then when he dies, it says, Vayesath, he was gathered. So first he gathers his sons together in the very first verse, and then he's gathered to his ancestors in the last verse. It's first of all, it's a beautiful comment on the generations, but also, as we've talked about before, the Bible's very reticent about what happens after you die. But one thing that it is clear about is that you go wherever your ancestors have gone. That's clear. So being gathered to your ancestors is another way of saying that you died. And even today, we have that instinct, right? We say that all the time, that at funerals, we say so-and-so, you know, was going back to so such-and-such who predeceased them, parents, spouse, children, whatever it is, we have that same instinct that somehow they're rejoined in that, in the tribe that outnumbers us all, which is the number of people who have lived and live no longer. The tribe that we're all gonna join someday. Okay, on that note, let's stop there for a minute and take questions and comments about, I'll just go right across, yeah.
My understanding of blessings, modern day blessings, is that they're good
things. Yes.
Some are good, some aren't good.
Well, they're blessings, they're quasi-blessings, they're also predictions. And some predictions, you know, are good and some predictions aren't. But they're mostly good. I mean, you know, Shimon and Levi aren't so good, but they're mostly good. Yeah, but that raises an interesting question, which is, does Jacob bless by what he knows is gonna happen, or does he influence what happens by the way he blesses? Which is I don't know. I mean, my assumption is that he blesses by what he knows is gonna happen. He can't change their fate, even if he wants to. That's my assumption, but it doesn't say for sure, yeah.
Does the disappearance of God, gradual disappearance, does that mimic how a parent's influence in a kid?
That's nice, very nice. That's what the Baal Shem Tov said. Someone once said to the Baal Shem Tov, you know, when I was young, I felt very close to God. But now that I'm older, I don't feel that way anymore. In fact, maybe I'll put this on Facebook. It's a good one. Glad, thank you for reminding me. I hope I don't forget it. So the Baal Shem Tov said, when your child is young and learning how to walk, what you do is you walk with them and then gradually you move further and further away so that they learn how to walk to you. God does the same thing. God moves further away so that you can learn how to walk to God. So, yeah. There's archaeologists have not found the cave. People who sell souvenirs have. There's a place in Israel that is identified as Me'arat HaMachpelah. Whether it is in fact the cave of Abraham, who knows? I mean, we're talking thousands of years. So it's impossible to know. And even if you excavated it and you found ancient bones, how are you gonna prove that they're Abraham's or Sarah's? So.
Is very similar to Yosef.
Yosef, yes. Yosef means addition. So it's like that. Added onto, gathered together. They have similar, yeah.
We always hear that may you, blessing may you be like that from the
Right.
Why were they so exemplary?
We went through five reasons in the last class. Believe it or not, listen to the last class and you will hear why Ephraim and Manasseh. We went through a bunch of different reasons why we chose those two. And I know, and I would be happy to repeat them all, except that for the people who were here, I'm gonna leave it aside. But the class is online if you're really interested. Or if you want to, the other thing is you can go to, if you email me, I'll send you the article from Bar-Ilan that gives, the professor at Bar-Ilan, whose article I used the basis for it, just email me and you can read the five reasons he offers. Yeah.
Why doesn't Jacob want to be buried near Rachel?
Why doesn't Jacob want to be buried near Rachel? So remember that Rachel's buried by the side of the road. And also that he wants to be buried with not just with his wife, but with his parents. It's like the family burial plot. So he's going to be buried in the family burial plot as opposed to by the road, and presumably it also says, remember that one of the reasons why people want to be buried in a certain place is because they want to draw their children back there. And that's where he wants to draw his children back, not by the side of the road, but by that, you know, traditional place where Abraham first bought the burial plot to bury his wife Sarah. And it's one of the sadnesses of the mobility of society is that parents are buried often in places where children rarely go because they live elsewhere across the country or so on. And so there are lots, what's that?
Like Singapore.
like Simi Valley, right. So there are lots of families that have unvisited graves because of geographical changes. But if there's a family that lives in one place and you can have the entire family buried in the same place or as many as possible, then that has a huge weight in terms of, yeah.
I think you've discussed this a year or two ago, but I need a refresher. If you use the notion of God talking to someone to make him a patriot, as opposed to not making Joseph a patriot,
right.
Why isn't Moses a patriot?
Well, Moses isn't a patriarch because the patriarchal age is over. It's just over. They were the founders of the tradition. Hundreds and hundreds of years later, Moses is something else. He's something else. Right, the patriarchal phase is the initial phase. And the question is, why does it close with Jacob instead of closing with Joseph? But it's almost like, this is not exactly equivalent, but why isn't Lincoln a founding father? It has nothing to do with the measure of his greatness, because you could argue that he was greater than Washington if you wanted to. I mean, you could argue it either way. But it does have to do with where he appeared in history. And actually, Moses is kind of equivalent to Lincoln that way, and Abraham to Washington. That is the indispensable first person, but also the one who constituted the nation as a nation for, you know, forever.
But our seminal began with the granting of Torah. The stuff previous perhaps was a different history.
It may, however you want to divide it up, it's still, but there's already a people by the time they go down to Egypt. So however you want to divide it up is fine. Depending on what rhetorical point you're trying to score, you can say that the United States was in its way a precarious nation until after the Civil War, when it was united, even though it wasn't so united, but when it moved towards the unity that eventually would. But I don't know. Either way. Yeah.
What's your opinion about people wishing to be buried in Israel now?
Well, it depends why you want to be buried in Israel. If you want to be buried in Israel for the traditional reason, which is that in the time of the resurrection, all Jews will go to Israel and you'll already be there, which is the traditional reason, then good luck to you. I'm skeptical of that as a reason to be buried in Israel. Let me put it that way. If you want to be buried in Israel just because you like the idea of being in Israel and you hope in some ways that will increase the force of gravity on your family so that maybe they're more likely to go to Israel or live in Israel eventually, I think that's a beautiful thing. Why not? There are Jews buried in every corner of this globe. Do you know there's a lovely story about an English soldier who fought in Israel and died, but he was Jewish. And at the time, there was some reason why they couldn't ship the body back to England. And this was at the beginning, it was like before 1948, so he was a British soldier, he was an occupying soldier, but he was a Jew. And they buried him in Israel, and they had to decide what to put on his grave. And I'm not sure I'm quoting it exactly, but the epitaph was something like, buried far from the land of his birth, buried at home. So it's the same idea. I mean, if you think of Israel as your home, I can understand why you want to be buried there, even if you've been buried in other places. When you travel, old Jewish cemeteries are a very powerful draw for Jews to see. There is something about where people were buried, and I can't explain it. I remember years ago when I took a trip with a conference of presidents to Germany, and we went to Kihilot Shum, Speyer, Worms, and Mainz, which were the three famous communities in Germany in the Middle Ages. And they had, I think it was in Mainz, this ancient Jewish cemetery, and they had some very famous rabbis from the Middle Ages, like Rabbi Meir of Rothenburg, and his grave was there. And now, this is from 1,000 years ago. I mean, there's certainly no physical remnant of his being there, but I was very moved to stand at his grave, and I can't tell you why. It's just something, I mean, that's just the way human beings work, so, yeah.
You spoke about God didn't speak directly to Joseph. So there's various ways that God can speak to us, because it says throughout the book that God was with Joseph.
Right.
And it said that God showed kindness to Joseph.
Yes.
And Joseph spoke probably more about God than anybody in the book.
All true.
He continued in front of Pharaoh.
Right.
In front of his adversaries, sharing who Yahweh was or who God the Most High was, and that he interprets dreams. He shared that there'd be peace with Pharaoh. To a point that he had this relationship that at the end, and I want you to talk about it, the naming of his sons, Manasseh and Ephraim. And he said that he helped, God made me forget all my toil.
Right.
And my father's household.
Yes.
And to me, that's a point that probably separated him from his family to some degree. And he attributes everything to God. He never attributes it. Like most
This is, remember, if you recall, this is why Joseph is called Yosef HaTzadik. That's exactly what the rabbi said, that the reason that Joseph is called Yosef HaTzadik is because every time he opens his mouth, he invokes God. Which makes it all that much more interesting that God never speaks to Joseph directly. And that was my point about the disappearance of God, is that not that God is absent from people's lives, but that a different mode of relating to God comes about gradually in the Torah. So it doesn't mean that, for example, Mordechai in the book of Esther doesn't think of God or doesn't feel like God motivates his life, but it's not the same direct intervention of God saying to Abraham, get up, go here, and stay there. That doesn't. So the question is, why there is there that shift? Why doesn't God speak directly to Joseph? It's not for a moment to suggest that God has no part in Joseph's life. I mean, it's clearly not the case, but that's what makes it that much more interesting that he doesn't speak to him directly. So, yeah. No, does it discredit his whole theory? No, it's a fascinating observation. We don't know exactly why the books were arranged the way they were, but I don't think you can discredit all of biblical criticism by virtue of the arrangement of the books, because there's a lot there. Even though people say the reverse, you know, that now they have computers that prove that the Torah was divine, and I'm not even going to go into that. But in fact, what computers really do is actually the opposite. Because now you can see with much greater precision the different layers and levels of Hebrew language, because you can run them through a computer. In the same way that if you ran Shakespeare's language and our language through a computer could tell you which words, right, could pick out very quickly which words were in currency in the 16th century that are no longer used, and could say this person is speaking at this time and this person is speaking at that time. Well, you can do that with Hebrew too. So there's a lot of stuff and a lot of evidence about biblical criticism. However, having said that, if you want, but if you want to say that the Torah has human hands in it, but that doesn't mean that it is only human, then these kinds of things are wonderful, because you can say not so fast that it's the same thing as Shakespeare. Because there's something else seems to be going on here that's very hard to explain. But I would say that, I mean, one of the things that makes the book as interesting as it is Friedman's own struggle with the fact that it contradicts the way that he thinks it's supposed to work. And it's really, and also when you follow, it's almost like a puzzle that the way he unravels it, and it works so precisely. That, I mean, it's not like, okay, there's a lot of God, then there's a little God, then there's a little more, then there's a little less, and eventually there's none. I mean, it's almost like a funnel. It almost really goes exactly like less and less and less and less and less as you read it. It's quite remarkable. So, anyway, yeah.
Even the Genesis, during that era, do you know how people prayed?
No, we don't know exactly how people prayed. There's a small book by Moshe Greenberg, who was a wonderful scholar of the Bible at Hebrew University, who died a couple of years ago, called Biblical Prose Prayer. And it was a breakthrough book because nobody had really studied the way people in the Bible pray before until Greenberg did. And what he says in the book is that the way people seem to pray in the Bible, as opposed to later Jewish history, is basically spontaneous outbursts of prayer as the occasion arises. Exactly what we don't think of as Jewish prayer, right? So you're in trouble and you'll say, like what Moshe does when Miriam is sick and he says, El na rafan Allah, please God, please heal her. And Greenberg says that's not the way we think of prayer as working. On Saturday morning in front of the Torah, you have a list of people and they're sick. And so he says, but that's not the way people prayed in the Torah. In the Torah, they prayed what they needed at the time they needed it and they just cried out to God. Which is, by the way, what the rabbis say too. Not only do they say that you can pray at any time in any place, but they also say you can pray in any language you understand. You don't have to pray in Hebrew, according to the rabbis. So, which makes sense if you think about it. And it's also our natural instinct is to pray in whatever language is close to us whenever we need to pray. But you understand why, or there are lots of reasons and pressures why organized prayer happens. But the most heartfelt prayers are usually not the ones that you have to get dressed up and go to synagogue and sit in your seat to say, right? They're the ones that happen by the hospital bedside.
Is the prayer supposed to be mouthed out, or could it be?
Well, the rabbis like you to say it. To say it because they feel as though, well, I think there are at least two reasons. One is that that to actually say something gives it a different feel than to think something. And the other is to say something is a greater acknowledgement that you're actually talking to someone, right? To say something is really to, so even in the Amidah, even though we call it a silent devotion, you're really supposed to say every word so that you can hear it for the same reason, to give the sense that you're talking to someone and because it takes greater effort to actually say it. And sometimes when you say things, they become more real. As you know, there are some things, I mean, in conversations all the time, there are things you don't want to say, even though both parties know them, because once you say them, they're said, you know, and you can't unsay them. And that's, yeah, anyway. So next time we will talk about Joseph, and let me just...